Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for August 17, 2025, the cover story, I never understood our data-saturated life until a hurricane shut it down. When Helene disconnected my part of North Carolina for weeks, my neighbors and I had to relearn old ways of knowing what was happening and what wasn't. This article was written by Trevor Quirk. Trevor Quirk is a writer living in Asheville, North Carolina. For this story, he spoke with residents throughout and around the city, interviewed public officials, and researched information theory. I heard a lot of "we're gonna dies." It was early on a Friday last September when Hurricane Helene sawed through the eastern seaboard, unleashing trillions of gallons of water over the southern states. By Sunday evening, the denizens of Warren Wilson College in western North Carolina were winding down their second day of recovery. A light bulb sun was dimming beyond the foothills on which the old farm school was built. The Swannanoa River had spilled into the college's crop and grazing fields. Halls and facilities had been hammered by falling trees. Roads and trails were blocked by debris or erased by floodwaters. Power and internet service was severed. Damian Fernandez, the president of the college and a social scientist by training, remained on campus, along with more than 300 students and dozens of professors, administrators, and staff members. He was updating students' parents by dictating blog posts to a colleague in Florida whenever cell reception permitted. Helene, he told me later, had disrupted every connection, physical or digital, between the school and the world, sequestering the campus in a vacuum of information. One bridge collapsed, he said. The other was underwater for the first day and a half. The roads were impassable and we were not getting any information from the outside world. We were totally cut off. Total disconnection was a defining experience across the region. Like many nearby neighborhoods and mountain towns, Warren Wilson College quickly reverted into something primordial, a sort of commune where information was shared, as Fernandez put it, through oral traditions. Each day, everyone gathered at 8:30 a.m. near the cafeteria, which housed one of the college's two generators, for a morning council, a routine that helped them strengthen morale, maintain a shared picture of their predicament, and delegate the labors of survival. Those labors were not unfamiliar to the students, who worked the land as part of their curriculums. Some cut down branches and cleared brush. Others did the heroic work of the poop crew, supplying flushing water and emptying portable toilets. Groups lugged hay and water to cows, pigs, and ewes. You find in some of these students an unusual marriage of sensibilities. The ruggedness of agrarian labor and bushcraft is coupled with the indiscriminate sensitivities of the liberal arts undergraduate. Flags had been planted throughout the college's fields to protect underground nests of yellow jackets. When those nests flooded, the wasps took to the air in a bewildered rage. Rosemary Thurber, a student studying environmental education, sympathized with the insects. She took meals by the garden where she worked and got used to them crawling on my lips as I was eating. That Sunday, it seemed as though the most perilous hours had passed. The flooding was receding. Students were cooking dinner on gas stoves and circulating among the few pockets of cell coverage, one by a gazebo, another higher up the hill near the campus chapel. Nobody remembers the true origin of the information that broke the tired rhythm of that evening. Sometime before dark, students began receiving alerts on their phones that a local dam was nearing failure. After sundown, many saw contractors driving through campus in a white truck with flashing overhead lights, blaring a warning through a megaphone. A dam had ruptured, they said, and everyone needed to flee to higher ground. As the message propagated, the exact structure that had failed alternated between two of several candidates. The nearby Beetree Dam retains around 500 million gallons of water. The North Fork Dam holds a reservoir of close to 6 billion gallons, which provides most of the drinking water for the city of Asheville. The failure of the Beetree Dam represented a grave danger to everyone on campus. The failure of the North Fork Dam would be a death sentence for every flightless creature in the valley. Students began stampeding out of buildings into the pitch black of night, as Fernandez described it. Most sprinted up the narrow paths that led to the soccer fields, their phones and flashlights a string of radiant beads along the hill. Students grabbed whatever was at hand, water bottles, jackets, first aid kits. A few leaped into a small car with a giant stockpot of soup that someone had been laboring over. Faces were obscured in the darkness, reducing people to voices and sounds. I heard a lot of, "We're gonna die," said one student, Jonah Turner. Small contingents diverged to warn others. A dean roused her upstairs neighbors. One of them, a woman with physical disabilities, initially asked to be left behind, fearing she would hamper the escape. The college's director of operations sprinted to the president's house and screamed Fernandez's name until he rushed outside. She relayed what she'd been told. The National Guard had prevented a public safety officer from returning to campus because of a reported dam failure, prompting the officer to contact someone at the college. Fernandez recognized the circuitous path this information had taken to reach them. It reminded him of the mayhem of other hurricanes he lived through in New York City and Florida, when the noise of transmission could amplify basic errors. His instinct was to verify the dam failure. He dialed 911 and got nothing. He managed to reach a vice president, but she remembers receiving the call as a broken sequence of words. Dam. Call. Call. Try to confirm. The students collected on the soccer fields twin sketches of yellowed grass that had been excavated out of the foothill and pressed into a lip, beyond which was tall wilderness. They tried different phones until they reached campus safety, who knew no more than they did. Half-truths and speculations began circulating, despite some students' attempts to organize communication by clapping into the darkness. Some began losing trust in what they heard. Turner remembers yelling matches and accusations of spreading misinformation. People would show up, he said, and yell, "I have the information," and then someone back in the woods 50 feet up the hill would say, "No, you don't." Thurber heard shrieks at the edge of the fields. Nobody had seen the little flag marking a nest, and now the yellow jackets were abroad. Somebody opened a first aid kit and cracked ice packs for the stings. Those who glanced skyward could see pockets of moonlit air and stars among a lake of clouds. A student named Trace Howard stood in the field, listening through the din for the distant roar of rushing water. Hurricane brain. Natural disasters are foremost understood in terms of their material impact, as damage to bodies, buildings, infrastructure, and economies. Helene brought winds, landslides, and flooding that killed hundreds, displaced hundreds of thousands, and wrought $70 billion in destruction across 6 states. This is how we catalog the wreckage left by floods and hurricanes, fires and earthquakes, blizzards and volcanoes. But in the 21st century, these calamities also cleave through information networks, disconnecting vast regions from the media and communications that would normally inform them about what was happening. Everywhere else in the United States, people could simply glance at a screen to learn of Helene's devastation. But those of us closest to that devastation had only the palest notion of its extent. Even those who watched homes hurtling down mountainsides didn't know whether the devastation was limited to what they could see or whether swaths of the country had washed away. To experience the disaster firsthand meant knowing almost nothing about it. Soon after Helene passed over western North Carolina, a NOAA satellite photographed the region at night. The picture revealed all the clots and axons of electric light that signal technological civilization, a bright network tracing the highways and roads between major cities. But you could also see a wide plaque of darkness stretching between the Florida Panhandle and Virginia. This was the ruinous path of the storm, Fernandez's vacuum of information made visible. When I saw that image, I thought of the communications theorist Marshall McLuhan. He once described electric light as pure information because it was what facilitated so many other visual media. For McLuhan, anything that could deliver information was a medium, not just the obvious formats, television, telephone, photographs, and so on, but also roads, railways, money, vehicles, satellites, clocks, and more. In the dark void captured by that satellite image, nearly every medium examined in McLuhan's 1964 book, Understanding Media, had been disabled. Gales tore down more than 13,000 utility poles, slicing telephone lines and power cables. Broadband lines were unraveled by groundwater surges. The satellite dishes, cell towers, and radio relays that protruded along the mountaintops were warped and toppled. Flooding sundered bridges and cleaved away jigsaw pieces of highways. Iron railways snapped in half. Thousands of vehicles were washed away. Banks closed. Digital clocks blinked off. And after sundown, interiors fell into a darkness in which even our trusty analog media, photographs, printed pages, became inaccessible. When information was needed most, it struggled to enter, leave, or traverse western North Carolina through modern channels or ancient ones. This profound disconnection occurs during many disasters. The wildfires in Southern California, the flooding in the hill country of Texas. Disasters can sever us, for a time, from what McLuhan called humanity's extended nervous system. The process of slowly mending your connections to that network is an experience out of time. In western North Carolina, recovering from Helene felt like recapitulating the entire history of information, or some harried version of it. Racing from the primordial back into modernity. We communicated first by word of mouth, then by handwritten signs and newsletters. We turned back to radio. We contended with fading cell signals and fickle satellite internet until our connection to the great network was fully restored. To return to the age of information was to feel, all at once, how important information is to human survival, and how our reliance on it leaves us perfectly vulnerable to manipulation and misinformation. Yet our strange deprivation also forced us to remember how minuscule the universe of information is compared with the greater world that contains it. It is difficult to imagine a wakeful person more ignorant of Helene's devastation than I was at first. On Friday morning, 2 days before the panic at Warren Wilson, I woke to the sight of my dog June, tilting her head as she stared out the bedroom windows. The tall pines were heaving, bent low like the arms of catapults. The sky was steely and unnaturally bright, like a screen of LEDs. The rain, dense and fast, looked like static in a degrading image. The night before, I spent hours plugging a leak in my basement, thinking that it was the work of the approaching storm. In fact, what meteorologists call A predecessor rain event had skirted ahead of Helene, saturating the soil and filling every creek, river, and reservoir before the genuine cyclone could drop an ounce of water in the state. I heard a click as the power failed. I lost cell coverage soon after that and cursed myself for not having messaged my partner, who was visiting family in San Diego. Around noon, I stepped outside to see that Helene had toweled the sky clean, leaving a cellophane sheen around sun and cloud. My house sits on a cul-de-sac in West Asheville, a mile or two outside the flood zone of the French Broad River. The neighborhood seemed largely unscathed. Water had pressed through foundations, wind had blown out the corrugated skirts of trailer homes, and a few downed trees had smashed chain-link fences or were leaning on roofs. But that was it. Across the lawn, I saw Chris Carlson, my neighbor, a big, affable guy who speaks with the flat vowels of the native Chicagoan. He spent the night upstairs minding a leak, listening to trees crack and fall, while his wife and their three children slept in the basement. My cluelessness bemused him. At that point, I still hoped the storm was little more than the ruiner of my weekend. But even Chris, who tracked Helene as it approached, admitted to having recalibrated his sense of the storm. Across the region, people began assembling a picture of Helene's effect in peals of information. But with communication down, the details weren't conveniently delivered to the mind. They had to be retrieved by the body, which navigated tree trunks and frayed wires to find them. Messages were written into the landscape. Driving outside Asheville days after the storm, one young man realized the severity of the flooding when he noticed mud on the leaves high in the trees. Chris was trading stories with two men by the French Broad River when they spotted an intact boxcar from the local train yard floating along as if it were no larger than a mailbox. As we rediscovered our surroundings, more distant lands were relegated to the imagination. "It's very strange being disconnected from the world like this," Chris told me the day of the storm. "I mean, Florida could be gone and we would have no idea." In those first 48 hours, I met many neighbors for the first time. Nobody knew much at first. Someone would drive out in search of relatives, supplies, or eddies of cell coverage, and when they returned, people would flock into the street as if our informant had come to distribute MREs. Knowledge was shared in a repetitive garble of official announcements, rumors, and speculation. I stood beside one neighbor's pickup as he rambled for a minor eternity about the destruction he saw beyond Asheville. "It's bad," he kept saying. I nodded dutifully, just as his wife had listened to me babble earlier. These were signs of what my partner would later call hurricane brain. I soon noticed other symptoms. With only a sleepy dog for company and no electronic media to distract me, the boredom was pulverizing. I drank. I read poetry. McLuhan believed that media technologies were extensions of the human senses and that they profoundly biased the Western mind toward sight, an imbalance that could be rectified through deprivation. In the airless quiet of my house, I experienced what McLuhan described as a dimming down of visual sense intensity. Sounds dominate my memory at that time. The wail of sirens, the chuffing of helicopters, the chortle and buzz of chainsaws, the squelch of a faucet running dry, the enviable chug of a neighbor's generator. In normal circumstances, we are awash in a flood of information, a profusion of data and stories about the world that distract and overwhelm us. In its absence, I felt my senses rebalancing to gather all their information from my direct experience. All of us in the area had to remember how to make sense of life this way. Everyone I have spoken with recalled a moment when all the shards locked into place and an understanding of Helene abruptly cohered. Many of these realizations came when glimpsing one of the swollen rivers, like the man who filmed his epiphany as he watched frothing water hiss over a golf green. Mine came on Sunday after I packed the dog into the car and inched through traffic toward the Bowen Bridge, stopping at a patch of cell reception indicated by dozens of people holding phones before their squinting faces. I called my partner, who cried when she heard my voice. I was confused. June and I were fine, happy campers. My partner was stuck in a Dallas-Fort Worth airport hotel, watching loops of diluvial footage on the television. I asked her which state had gotten the worst of Helene. Florida? Her tone sank. North Carolina's power companies had only begun assessing the damage to the electrical grid, let alone repairing it. Asheville's major water treatment plant was crippled, and the city would not regain service for weeks or months. The River Arts District was a sunken ruin. Shipments of food and gasoline could not reach the city. Hospitals were in pandemonium. Hundreds were missing. I looked around. I'd been thinking of Helene as a crisis that merely glanced against my life, one I might otherwise have seen on a television like the one my partner was gazing into. I looked at the torpid traffic on Patton Avenue, heard the horns, and realized that most of the cars were trying to leave. For 2 seconds, radio was cooler than Mark Zuckerberg. The Friday that Helene arrived, Mark Starling was on air by 5 a.m. He had slept for only a few hours after a long night of storm coverage. Starling is a thin, avuncular man with a mountainous gray-flecked beard and a true radio voice, smooth syllables accentuating a boyish, sentimental tone. He grew up and worked for years in Florida, broadcasting through about 30 hurricanes by his count. He and his producer, Tank Spencer, felt obligated to inform their North Carolina audience, for whom major cyclones were a rare experience. Starling had already learned that information was an imperfect motivator. A day earlier, he told me, he failed to persuade his wife to evacuate their home with their son and 4 dogs. They live in Black Mountain, a small town east of Asheville, whose devastation is now infamous across the region. The local fire chief told Starling to have his wife take a Sharpie marker and write her social security number on her forearm because she's not going to make it. Starling's wife chose to remain. The last time Starling heard from his family was just before the broadcast. His wife called from an SUV parked at a gas station. Water was pouring over the top of the Interstate 40 overpass, and all the other routes out of Black Mountain were underwater. From that moment onward, Starling said, she could hear me because she was listening to the radio, but I didn't have any idea where the hell she was. Helene marooned Starling and Spencer in the WWNC radio station, perched atop a hill in West Asheville. Leveled trees crushed the entrance gate. They spent much of the next 15 days there, subsisting on a supply of half-smoked sausages and chili in the refrigerator. It wasn't long before they realized that with internet and cell access disrupted, radio had become the most dependable medium for mass communication. The station, powered by a diesel generator, became a de facto information hub, as Starling put it. For 2 seconds, he laughed, radio was cooler than Mark Zuckerberg. McLuhan saw radio as a medium through which language could achieve its fullest import. When words were spoken, he said, information arrived drenched in significance and feeling, binding people to one another more durably than visual media could. After the rise of television, radio had been relegated into a kind of nervous information system, coursing with news bulletins, time signals, traffic, and weather reports. This was the function that Starling would serve. He took calls from throughout the region, centralizing information that had been limited to far-flung places. All of it confirmed that Helene was worse than anyone imagined. Sometime around 10 a.m., Starling recognized the name of a longtime listener on a monitor, Michael Dry. The elderly lawyer was reporting from his house along the former shores of the Swannanoa River. The basement was submerged and the first floor was filling. Dry had retreated upstairs with his wife, Nora, his daughter, Megan, and his grandson, Micah. Peering out a window, he saw water lapping at the height of his 10-foot fence. "If I want to try to look at the bright side of this," he joked, "we were thinking about downsizing." Starling's laugh was obliging, two helpless exultations. "The Swannanoa River is about a mile wide," Dry paused. "I kid you not, an 18-wheeler trailer is floating. It just went past my property. I've never seen anything like this." Starling implored Dry to call back around midday. According to the Asheville Citizen Times, the Dry family was eventually forced up onto the roof. They sat on the shingles for a few hours, watching the buildings around them buckle and plunge. Then their house collapsed, and the waters tore them away from one another. Michael, Nora, and 7-year-old Micah drowned. Micah's mother, Megan, was rescued that evening, hypothermic and battered, but alive. Starling wouldn't learn any of this until later. Around 2:30 that afternoon, cell reception seemed to disappear, but calls like Michael Dry's had expressed what Starling described as a common desperation, eliciting a similar feeling inside the station. "We were desperate to help," he said, "and we weren't sure if what we were doing on air was helping." He shifted the broadcast from merely informing listeners to serving as a resource network. His efforts were bolstered when a friend hiked up to the station with a ham radio. A day later, colleagues would bring satellite equipment to help restore internet and phone access. As Starling and Spencer fielded calls and messages, they developed a triage system. Spencer would write down emergencies and requests on post-it notes and arrange them on the switchboard and computer monitors. Starling would broadcast the information, and soon enough, they would hear that one need or another had been met. Somebody's missing aunt or mother was found by a neighbor. Residents besieged by fallen trees discovered men with chainsaws at their curbs. Good Samaritans taxied people to emergency shelters or delivered medicine to retirees. Residents stockpiled food and supplies at drop zones coordinated through the broadcast. Starling and his colleagues provided this service live and commercial free, 24/7 for 14 days, he said. He estimated that Spencer wrote hundreds of post-it notes, maybe 1,000. "Every time we've cleaned the studio since the storm, we continue to find more." The Sunday of that first weekend, Starling was switching to another call when he hesitated. "Line 5, is that who I think it is?" The distinctive spelling of his wife's name, Brandy, had appeared on his monitor. She, their son, and the dogs were alive and unharmed. They just left a town hall meeting in Black Mountain. Admirably keeping to format, Brandy began recapping the meeting for listeners. It gave Starling time to compose himself. He pleaded with her, "Travel to the radio station, bring the dogs, find a way. It's so good to hear your voice," he said. Overtake the FEMA site. Information networks are agnostic to the messages they deliver. This is by design. The meaning of a message, the polymath Claude Shannon wrote in 1950, is generally irrelevant. That idea let Shannon and others develop the theoretical groundwork of virtually every information technology we use today. All our efforts to moderate or verify the information those networks carry on the internet, for instance, are just a frantic afterthought about a system that is designed to blindly store and move data. The social problems this presents are obvious. If, as McLuhan believed, our modern networks extend the capacity of the human nervous system to transmit information, then transmitting False information extends another human capacity, hallucination. This is what happened at Warren Wilson College. Students and staff members received news of a dam's collapse through authoritative channels, emergency text systems, and indirect communications from the National Guard. But it was misinformation. It took about an hour for Fernandez to confirm that neither the Beatry Dam nor the North Fork Dam had failed. The correction traveled through the same human network that delivered the error until it reached the students huddled on the soccer fields. Many refused to believe it and asked that Fernandez reassure them personally. "Who knew that they trusted me so much?" he said. While you're operating in this distressed system of communication, interpersonal communication, the human, the direct, almost compensates for that. He ascended the hill in the darkness and promised everyone that it was safe to come down. Many dams in the southeast had their turns at failing and then holding. The National Weather Service in Greenville, South Carolina, reported an imminent failure of the Lake Lure Dam. It was close, but it held. A Tennessee mayor posted on Facebook that the Waterville Dam had suffered a catastrophic failure. It had not. The Tennessee Valley Authority put the Nolichucky Dam on red alert, indicating an inevitable failure, and then downgraded it hours later. Clay Chandler, a public information officer for Asheville's Water Resources Department, said the city received a report about a dam failure almost every day for a couple of weeks after the storm. It was hard to blame people for assuming that a dam had failed, he said, given the unnatural amount of water rushing through the region. He was also quick to note that if not for its new auxiliary spillway completed in 2020, he had no doubt that the North Fork Dam would have failed. It was equally difficult to chastise the officials who relayed rumors of dam failures, most likely on a better safe than sorry basis. As for the origin of the bad information, I kept hearing the same two speculative stories, each beginning with a phone call, one from an onlooker who had mistaken the activation of spillways for a dam failure, another from someone who was misreporting the failure on purpose. In the weeks after the storm, the idea of someone lying about such things became less and less shocking. The vital flows of modern living, electricity, water, information, returned slowly, each on its own mysterious time. My partner flew to Atlanta and drove into Asheville with enough supplies to last us weeks. We soon learned from a cardboard sign that there was a nearby slope you could summit for a decent cell signal. We called it Reception Hill. From its top, we spoke to family, read the news, messaged our workplaces. We were regaining contact with civilization. One afternoon, my partner was answering emails when a woman emerged from her house to share an urgent update. FEMA wasn't helping us because it was busy taking care of illegal immigrants in Florida. Ah, we were regaining contact with civilization. I would like to take a brief moment now to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Helene passed over us in the final weeks of the 2024 presidential race, making it an ideal incubator for political disinformation. Much of it concerned FEMA. Elon Musk repeated false claims that FEMA was actively blocking shipments and seizing goods and services. A widely circulated post on X falsely claimed that hurricane victims are now realizing that the $750 from FEMA that Kamala Harris is offering them is actually a loan, not real relief, and if they don't pay it back, the feds can seize their property. Theories swirled about secret morgues. Eustace Conway, a former reality TV star who founded the Turtle Island Preserve in Boone, North Carolina, claimed that 18-wheeler refrigerator trucks filled up with dead bodies were moving through the area. The most notorious theory asserted that the federal government had geoengineered the hurricane. Yes, they can control the weather, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia wrote, in order to appropriate lithium deposits near Lake Lure or the devastated village of Chimney Rock. FEMA and North Carolina officials rebuked these and other fabrications, but the poison was already in the water. Not long after the storm, an exasperated man called into Dan Abrams' national radio program to say that his father-in-law was refusing assistance from FEMA because he feared that they're going to take his house. A young medical assistant was helping people at a makeshift clinic at a grocery store outside Lake Lure when he heard gossip about FEMA not delivering supplies to the area. After word circulated that unsavory characters raided donations, he watched as a sleepless pastor retrieved an assault rifle. If it came to it, he was going to protect his flock. Not far from there, an armed 44-year-old man was arrested after threatening FEMA workers. On social media, he had tried to rally volunteers to overtake the FEMA site in Lake Lure and send the products up the mountains. As Starling noted, much of the disinformation came from outside the disaster zone. As any information network expands, its members become increasingly remote from the places and events being discussed. The network connects human beings to one another by disconnecting them from reality. Online, Helene was dislocated, disembodied, and decontextualized, transformed into bloodless figments of information, images, videos, words, whose underlying reality, crushing, drowning, destruction, the mind had to constantly reaffirm. This is the imaginative labor that our extended nervous system demands of us. Without that labor, information remains an abstract clay, endlessly contortable for those who might benefit from its adjustment, and eternally delightful to those who prefer a malleable dream world to a concrete reality. The childlike drama of the most popular conspiracy theories, the weather machines, secret morgues, and palm-rubbing bureaucrats, suggest that some people looked at communities in distress as if they were mere playthings of the mind. It seemed odd at first that Asheville's protracted water crisis, an event that could not have been better engineered to generate disinformation, was basically untouched by it. It took more than 50 days to resume the supply of potable water, and nearly every step in the process required a public crash course in hydrology or resource management. Once the roads to the North Fork treatment plant had been rebuilt and an enormous bypass line replaced, there was the problem of turbidity, a measure of the particulates clouding a fluid. The city collaborated with the EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to restore service, including the installation of turbidity curtains that would, in theory, encourage all the sediment deposited by the storm to fall. The city also rerouted superchlorinated water into the distribution system to enable flushing, cleaning, and firefighting. You could shower in it if you kept your mouth shut. If you could drink nothing else, you were advised to boil it first. Once the turbidity fell, the city resumed water treatment, taught residents how to flush their plumbing, and published frequent lab tests to assure people that the water was safe. But as one problem was being solved, another emerged. The city announced that lead had been detected in the water at some elementary schools, which were thankfully still using bottled water. The public was terrified, especially after a chemist and a chemical engineer reached out separately to the Asheville watchdog to warn that lead exposure could be more widespread than believed. The city delicately explained that its distribution system contained no lead whatsoever, but the plumbing of older buildings often did. Ordinarily, the city treats its water with anti-corrosion agents so it won't leach metal from older pipes, but this practice was interrupted after the storm. Once normal water treatment resumed, the school's lead problem would resolve itself. Anticipating that its population might desire further reassurance, the city distributed nearly 8,000 free test kits and published results showing drinking water well within regulatory limits. The conspiracy theories, I presumed, would write themselves, but no matter how eagerly I combed Nashville and its environs for unglued ideas about the water, I found nothing beyond moderate skepticism at superchlorination and what seemed like more households storing emergency water supplies. Chandler also saw very little disinformation. Nothing beyond the stray Facebook comment here and there, nothing organized, he said. And I'm grateful for that, because in that kind of environment, that could have very easily happened. Why didn't it? One potential answer comes from a seminal 1948 book called Cybernetics, in which the mathematician Norbert Wiener explored how different systems use information to maintain their stability. For small communities, he wrote, this challenge could be met through direct social involvement, speaking to others, sharing their space. It was larger communities like a state or a country that had to resort to complexes of media whose every node was susceptible to distortion and control. This vulnerability would often destabilize the entire network. It's no coincidence that humanity's largest information network, the Internet, is plagued by paranoia and suspicion. Information can travel frictionlessly across a vast system, but the good intentions and mutual commitment that knit people into society often cannot. Helene, in its blind violence, carved out the boundaries of a communal experience across and beyond Western North Carolina. I could not initially appreciate why so many of the residents policed these boundaries. Why, for instance, it was important to many of those I interviewed that I lived in the area. In the 21st century, what did I know about Helene that an outsider couldn't easily learn? But this was naive. These people were not guarding information. They were guarding trust, the incalculable confidence we can place in others when we know they drink the same water we do. Is it smoky at your house? In March, 6 months after the hurricane, it was unseasonably dry. I stood on my street gazing at a sheet of smoke that obscured the tree line. I felt as though someone were blocking my vision with a sign and insisting that I read it. Because I apparently cannot stay apprised of life-threatening developments, I had only recently learned from my mother's text, "Is it smoky at your house?" that several large wildfires were raging outside Asheville, burning through the debris and deadwood left by Helene. I felt like I'd learned nothing. You could also say that I had not fully emerged from my hermitage. The necessities and comforts of civilization had returned, but I sometimes wished that the flow of information had not. Helene had resensitized me to the emotional needling of online media, which became intolerable during and after the election. The primal feelings this media provoked in me, I noticed, often had no link to my daily life. I felt a kind of nausea, one that kept turning me away from virtual sensations and back toward my own direct experience. I was not alone in this. Some residents were reluctant to surrender the serenity of a life without screens. Others feared that returning to technology and civilization would erode the solidarity they'd found with their neighbors. In the immediate aftermath of the storm, both Starling and Fernandez felt a vehement indifference to political affiliation and were loath to relinquish that sentiment. Starling says he declined overtures from national and local campaigns from both parties because it felt wrong to offer up the troubles of Western North Carolina as fodder for political discourse. It is tempting to say that Helene provided us an unplanned hiatus from the flood of information that addles the contemporary mind, the torrents of data and noise that overtake the trickles and rivulets of our senses. But this is backward. The problem with our direct sensory experience of the world is that it contains too much information, too much data, too many interpretations, too much meaning. The philosopher Eugene Gendlin once described it as a myriad richness that presents us with far more than our conceptual structures can encompass. We feel more than we can think, he wrote, and we live more than we can feel. It is experience that is the flood, the borderless amnion we have always lived within and cannot escape. What is degrading about the blitz of digital information into the mind is not its abundance, but its meagerness. Its bland volumes insist that mere information can sum to the richness of experience, that words, pictures, and videos can fully capture what it is like to endure a hurricane, that our activity on social media is equivalent to the essential human behaviors it simulates, that you can truly know the world through the curated and recycled observations, ideas, and messages of other people. Interacting with a network is a variety of experience, of course, but it is one that is impoverished by abstraction, remoteness, and endless mediation. On the internet, we even tacitly recognize the pettiness and insufficiency of these virtual sensations. Those most sickened by them are advised to touch grass. Don't look, but touch. There are mysteries and meanings that live in our contact with the world and with one another that do not survive in the traffic of a network. And now some of the reader's comments from this article, and these are folks who live in the area, Western North Carolina. First from Sue, she says, just from WNC. This article brought back many memories of living through Helene's aftermath in Asheville. My neighbors and I were spared many of the worst aspects, but the lack of information was staggering. At first, any information was only what we could see within walking distance. After a few days, our only source of information came from BPR, a local NPR station that did twice daily updates with officials. For days, 100 or so of us would gather in a large room with someone who had a battery-powered boombox to listen to these reports. Fortunately, with that, we were spared all the media disinformation conspiracy theories. My neighbors and I were all extremely grateful for all the assistance we received from the first responders, volunteer organizations, and FEMA. And from Travelers, who is from Western North Carolina. It's been difficult for me to read articles about what happened to our town area because it was such an overwhelming experience, but my husband thought this was a worthwhile read. We live in one of the hardest hit towns, Swannanoa, and the recovery is still ongoing. In the blink of an eye, we were living without water, electricity, and communication, and our small country road was impassable, so completely isolated. We live a 5-minute drive from Warren Wilson College, but it may as well have been another continent. I'm still processing the experience. We were personally fortunate because of a slightly higher elevation, our house was spared damage, unlike our close neighbors. We also heard all the same rumors with no way to verify. In some way, it was harder for everyone trying to reach us. I was stunned that friends from different countries knew more than we did for the first few days when we knew nothing but what we saw outside our front door. And finally, from Jean T. in Asheville. NPR was our lifeline. It was the only source of reliable information. Without NPR, we would have floundered while looking for food and water. Without NPR, we would not have known where volunteers were needed most and would not have been able to help our neighbors. NPR was our lifeline. And now, with the few minutes we have remaining, I'll share with you from the Ethicist column. Do I tell my brother that he's not our dad's son? Despite knowing that my brother wasn't his, My father has always treated my brother as his own. What happens to his sense of identity if he finds out? And as always, this ethical question is being answered by Kwame Anthony Appiah. I recently discovered that my brother, whom I was raised to believe is my full sibling, is in fact my half-brother. Our parents separated when we were young, and both of us grew up with our mother in a different country from where our father lives. Since the split, 3.5 decades ago, my mother has essentially had no contact with him. She raised us to believe that he was a despicable, selfish man whose behavior had made her marriage intolerable. As an adult, however, I've learned that the story is more nuanced. I've come to realize that my mother has stretched the truth and sometimes outright fabricated many important things about her life. One of these things is not coming clean about who my brother's real father is. I harbored suspicions for years, but they were only confirmed last year when I visited my ailing father. He told me the real reason for their separation. She had been unfaithful to him. He also told me that I am his only biological child. Despite knowing that my brother wasn't his, my father has always treated my brother as his own. My brother still regards my father as his biological father. My question is whether I owe it to my brother to let him know the truth, and whether I should confront my mother about the fact that I know this. My mother is not one to face facts with grace when confronted, and she will shut down and potentially cut off our relationship if I reveal to her that I know. I also fear uprooting my brother's sense of identity when he finds out the person he has called dad all his life is not actually his biological father. What should I do? And the ethicist responds, "These kinds of family revelations are never only about biology. They're about identity, trust, and the stories that help us make sense of ourselves. Your mother's impulse to hide and reshape the past is, however misguided, all too human. Parents often want to shield their children, and sometimes themselves, from pain and complexity. Your father's silence, too, was probably motivated by a desire to avoid making anyone's life harder, even if it meant keeping your brother in the dark. The stories we're given as children, though, don't always serve us as adults. It will be difficult for your brother to recognize that he has been living inside a story that isn't quite true. Yet I hope you'll choose to share what you know with him, because he's entitled to the fuller version. And I hope you'll frame it in a way that makes it clear you're in this together, that family, for all its tangled roots, is built not just on blood, but on care and the choices we make for one another. He may find pain in the revelation, but he may also find comfort in, say, your dad's steadfastness. And if he wants to seek out his biological father, let's hope it's not too late. The question of what to say to your mother is, as you explain, highly fraught. But just as your brother is entitled to the truth about his parentage, your mother is entitled to know what her children now understand about her past. Your relationship with her shouldn't be premised on prevarication about matters central to your shared lives. You fear she may find it nearly impossible to talk honestly about these things. Still, as you move forward, it may help to think in terms less of confrontation than of honesty, as a steady opening toward a relationship that's less hemmed in by secrets. This doesn't have to happen all at once. You and your brother are the ones most affected, and it's up to you to decide what you need and when. Then you can begin to ask what kind of future and what kind of relationships you want to build from here. And the second ethical dilemma published in today's New York Times Magazine, how do I tell my religious friend to stop inviting us to church? I've recently become friends with a woman who is an evangelical Christian. I am not religious myself, but have studied Buddhism for a time and hold firmly that one should not overtly try to convert others into believing the same things I do. My friend and I both have daughters the same age as well as younger sons. Our kids enjoy spending time together and benefit from one another's companionship. My dilemma is that this friend often socially extends invitations to us that are religious in nature. For example, she recently invited my daughter to join her daughter for Bible study. She has sent invites for us to send our kids to the Christian camps where her children attend camp. Although I see these invites as well-meaning, they make me deeply uncomfortable, especially because I don't understand the intention. I have mentioned to her casually that we don't attend religious services or church. Yet despite this, we still receive invites to their church events. Given that I have a strong personal feeling against trying to convert others to any belief, should I say something to her? And the ethicist responds, Christianity became a world religion by spreading the gospel, a word that comes from Old English for good news. The term evangelical itself goes back to the Greek for bringing a good message. So your friend, in wanting to share her faith, is following a tradition that's central to Christian history and belief. Still, in a tolerant, pluralistic society, people will inevitably disagree about what counts as good news, and she knows you're not a churchgoer. Part of what keeps the peace is recognizing that convictions about the ultimate questions don't have to be shared, and that not everyone wishes to participate in religious life. Your discomfort is reasonable. You have no interest in converting anyone, and it's fair to expect the same restraint from others. If the invitations keep coming, you're within bounds to be direct. You can tell her that you respect how important her faith is to her and appreciate how well meant her invitations are, but that you and your family simply approach these things differently and aren't interested in church activities. Reassure her that this isn't about valuing her friendship or your children's any less, and that it doesn't reflect any lack of enthusiasm for spending time together. And if conversation drifts toward what you each believe in a spirit of openness and curiosity, that's fine too. At its best, friendship can absorb these differences and even grow stronger by having them out in the open, handled with candor and care. And that is all the time we have for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. Thank you so much for joining me, and please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.